Thank you, Lee, and welcome, everyone. So we're here to talk about Walter Rodney. I always find it remarkable to talk about Rodney because he's someone who did not live a very long time. He was assassinated in 1980 at the tender age of 38, but obviously his life has had such an impact that we're here to discuss his legacy. So I wanted to frame that discussion to pretty much talk about why are we talking about Walter Rodney today? Well, in part, it has to do with the fact that Rodney's ideas have received a new audience, right? So there's been a recent republishing of some of his works, like Groundlings with My Brothers, and his seminal work, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, as well as the manuscript he wrote on the Russian Revolution being published as a book by Verso Books. From a Guyanese perspective, one of the things that has brought Walter Rodney back into prominence is the fact that in 2016, they held a commission of inquiry into the assassination of Walter Rodney. That inquiry ended up with a finding that the government at the time in the 1980, the Guyana's People's National Congress, was in fact responsible for Walter Rodney's assassination. And the government that was in power that launched the inquiry, the People's Progressive Party, could have done it at any time from when they came to power in 1992 up until 2016. But what happened was that Rodney's legacy doesn't fit perfectly into anyone's playbook. And his life and his assassination have been uncomfortable facts for Guyana's ruling political party as well as the opposition. As I said before, the People's National Congress was found in the Commission of Inquiry to have assassinated Rodney. But then the main opposition party at the time, the People's Progressive Party, and both of those parties considered themselves socialists, would have to explain why, as the largest opposition party based on the working class with a base in the sugar workers, they themselves were not allied with Walter Rodney at the time. So it is these things that bring us to talk about Walter Rodney. And of course, some people would know that annually in Atlanta, the Walter Rodney Symposium is held there as well. This year, the keynote speaker there was Angela Davis, who spoke on Rodney and his legacy, and is also someone who's contributed the foreword to one of his recently republished books. I also would like to speak about Rodney from a particularly Guyanese perspective, because as a tiny country with less than a million people, the only English-speaking country in South America, the history of our country and things happening presently kind of bewilder people. But you can't understand Walter Rodney without understanding Guyana. So Rodney was born, you know, in Guyana in a period of like a lot of ferment, right? It was the anti-colonial movement. And he was born and raised in a very particular time before what we would describe as the big racial split in politics in Guyana. Both Afro-Guyanese, who were descended from enslaved Africans, and Indo-Guyanese, descended from Indian indentured laborers, formed the People's Progressive Party as part of the anti-colonial struggle against the British. And eventually there was a split along racial lines. But as Rodney was growing up, one of the things he did in a household filled with activists was that he would sell the newspaper of the People's Progressive Party. And Rodney is very much a creature of the Caribbean. He is part of the education system there, where like other Caribbean revolutionaries like C.L.R. James, he distinguished himself academically. And in the Caribbean, for those who know, when you're leaving the elementary school system to get into the secondary school system, you have to take an entrance exam. And both C.L.R. James and Walter Rodney are people of such brilliance that they scored into the top school. People like me got into school number 3, which is still a sore point with my family. But you know, they're distinguished scholars, and in many ways, social mobility in the Caribbean is tied to leaving the Caribbean. So you'd not be surprised to know that both James and Rodney emigrated to continue their studies. And Rodney went to England, where he attended the School of the Americas. Not the School of the Americas. If you know why that's a big slip up. The School of Oriental and African Studies. And that's where he did a lot of his research, but he also engaged in what was politics at the time. You know, he'd be in their Hyde Park giving speeches on issues of the day, and he did this painstaking research that would lead to him writing these books. And if you examine Walter Rodney's intellectual legacy, you'll see that there's this unceasing and ruthless criticism of all things existing, which is the Marxist method. And Rodney didn't just do this academically, he lived his life as such. And if you've ever read his Groundlings with My Brothers, Rodney did this thing where, like, you know, I'm kind of mad I'm up on the stage at a podium because I can't really fully demonstrate it, but Groundlings is literally about sitting on the ground and talking to people. So when Rodney was a lecturer at the University of the West Indies at the Kingston campus, in addition to building with his students there and teaching about Black history, he would leave the campus and go into working class and Rastafarian communities and literally sit on the ground and speak with them and do an inquiry with them to see what is going on in their lives and understand their struggles, and in turn also teach them what he knew about Black history. And I think it's a challenge for everyone in the movement today, especially since those of us who enter the movement tend to come from more comfortable backgrounds. A lot of us work in academia. How do we build connections with the working class? And I think the answers are found in Rodney himself, but like Rodney would tell you, no answers really come easily. You have to do a lot of painstaking research to get to it. A good example would be one of Rodney's lesser known works, which is the history of the Guyanese working people that he wrote. And one of the things he calculated in there, I'm like, I don't know who has time to do this, but Rodney calculated the tons of earth moved by enslaved Africans to create the irrigation system that exists in modern day coastal Guyana, for example. And it, in asking questions about, you know, like, he would give presentations like this pretty often, and people would get into the audience and say, oh, well, Mr. Rodney, you know, how do we know? Like, should we choose socialism? Is it capitalism? And he once gave a speech on race and class in Guyanese politics at Columbia University, and a young man got up in the audience and asked something like that. Is it socialism? Is it capitalism? And I've always found Rodney's response to be very indicative, because he told the young man, you know, I could tell you almost as an act of faith, yes, socialism is the way forward. But what you really need to do is look at your own life, look at society, and ask yourself, where am I going? And more importantly, what's stopping me from achieving the things I want to achieve? And assess from there, you know, like, what ideological framework you want to get into to build what you want to build. Some of you who know me know that some of the things I've done in my time on the left is that I volunteered at the Marxist Internet Archive, so I've done the transcription from some of the works on there for C.L.R. James and Raya Dunayevskaya and other people. One of the things I've transcribed is called a document by James called Walter Rodney and the Question of Power. And it's a memorial speech C.L.R. James gives after Walter Rodney is assassinated in 1980. And Rodney points, James points out that what Rodney had is something James didn't have. Rodney had a generation of people like C.L.R. James, Amy Césaire, and Claudia Jones to look to as mentors. James says that when he entered the field in the early 20th century, he had to blaze a trail. For people like me, I have the honor of seeing both James and Rodney as political mentors. But as a Guyanese, I'm actually, in some ways, cut off from that legacy. So I like to tell people this story, that when I, you know, I was now getting into socialism and radicalism, and I was a student at Prince George's Community College in Maryland. I was part of this radical group called Just Cause. And, you know, we made enough of a name for ourselves that the Lyndon LaRoucheites, if you know them, decided, which is a fringe radical group, to come visit us on campus. And we're exchanging ideas, and one of them goes, oh, brother, you're from Guyana. Tell me your thoughts and feelings about Walter Rodney. And I said, who? Because the reality is, as somebody who went through the Guyanese education system from nursery school all the way to secondary school, you know, I wrote my Caribbean Examination Council exams, my CXCs, before coming to the United States. This man was not mentioned in the curriculum, despite the fact that he specifically wrote children's books, right? To try to address things like, what does it mean to be Black? What does it mean to be African? What does it mean to be Indian? And this is why I mentioned that both the political parties in Guyana are responsible for this, because at any time when the People's Progressive Party came to power in 1992, they could have integrated Walter Rodney into the curriculum, but they didn't. I think it was around 2017 I was in Guyana, and I was like, okay, I'm here. I'm gonna go to the National Archives, I'm gonna find out everything I can about Walter Rodney. After all, the National Archives are called the Walter Rodney Archives. And I was quickly informed that, and I'll turn Guyanese for a second, you know, we only have three or four books about Walter Rodney here. You know, we don't have much. And it's literally like they had Groundlings with My Brothers, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. I thought they would have the whole catalog of, like, Rodney's Working People's Alliance newspaper that I could sift through, and it's a very deliberate effort to push away the legacy of somebody who's uncomfortable. And even today, you know, Rodney can't be clearly claimed by any part of the socialist movement. We know there's like great divisions in the socialist movement when it comes to international issues, for example. During the book launch for Rodney's book on the Russian Revolution, Vijay Prashad, who wrote the foreword, for example, claimed that, you know, we have socialists today who would stand up and say that we should put a no-fly zone over Syria, but Walter Rodney would never say that. Now, I'm not good at divining the dead, so I won't. So I can't tell you what Rodney would or would not say. But I can look at his methodology and try to answer questions, right? So one of the things we often talk about on the socialist left is it race or is it class that is the primary question? And in that same aforementioned speech of race and class in Guyanese politics, Rodney says, well, for me, class is fundamental. But what is more important is not race or class, but rather how race and class interact in specific historical moments and what are the lessons you can draw from that. And this is, to me, the essence of Rodneyism, if there is such a thing, right? That he challenges you not to act from abstractions, but to investigate things specifically, whether it's the tons of earth moved by Africans in early Guyana, or what the specific interactions of race and class are in a particular area. And Rodney put this, he has these series of lectures that he did when he was in Hamburg, Germany, and he talked about how comfortable historians are investigating the past, because the past is dead. As he put it, they're very comfortable with mummies. But if you try to interpret the present, if you try to challenge living history, that's where you're running into trouble. And Rodney's life is a life, in many ways, of running into trouble. When he studied in England and he sat at the feet of C.L.R. James and other people, he ran into trouble for not knowing the right answers. When he was part of building Ujamaa socialism in Tanzania under Julius Nyerere, he had the nerve to write an op-ed criticizing the progress of the revolution, to which Nyerere wrote a scathing rebuttal, which Rodney in some ways responded and acknowledged, okay, maybe you're right. When Rodney was in Jamaica, I don't know if folks know his history in Jamaica, but he was such a firebrand that he became investigated by the Jamaican government at the time. They kept a file on him, and he was critical of even the left wing of the government there. In writing about race and class and Guyanese politics, he, for example, was trying to give a criticism of how it is that some elite politicians will use the process of racial identification to win the working class to their side. And the person he decided to critique was Jomo Kenyatta, the anti-colonial leader of Kenya. You know, like, you have to be pretty much into this ruthless criticism thing to be bringing this up. And Rodney's ultimate demise in Guyana came from his militant fight against the Burnham government at the time. And to illustrate that, you know, the Burnham government at the time was actually considered part of the socialist and Pan-African movement, right? So when Zimbabwe gained its independence in 1980, they invited Burnham to be one of the honorees, and they also invited Walter Rodney. But at the time, Burnham's government in Guyana was actually pretty strict against Rodney. They'd revoked his traveling privileges. Rodney traveled what we call a backtrack. He went through the quarantine, and then he moved on to Suriname and then French Guyana. He flew to Europe and then eventually made his way to Zimbabwe. So you could imagine Burnham's shock at the conference to see this man who he's banned from traveling there. But not just that, he had to suffer another indignity, because as they're hosting the independence celebrations, they recognize Walter Rodney in the audience, and they say, today we have a preeminent Pan-Africanist and socialist in the audience who must come and give a speech. So Rodney comes and he gives a speech, and there's the president of his country sitting there just stewing, right, in his juices. And this is quintessential Walter Rodney for me. And I think to be able to reclaim his legacy is in many ways an honor and a privilege. And in essence, he tells people, and I'm going to paraphrase here, that in the struggle for a better world, the agents of that struggle is the working class. And he makes clear that the struggle for black liberation is key to that, because it is the black working class that has built the basis of modern day capitalism. And he says that only the working class can liberate the working class, and that anyone who tells you opposite is trying to fool you or fool themselves. That freedom is not a gift. Freedom is something for which we fight, and then we win. And I think I have a few more minutes, but I actually just end on that note, because I think it is, again, in essence, that the self-emancipation of the working class is the goal, and that as we look at the class struggle, it's also important not just to look at the struggle between classes, but also the struggle within classes, right? Walter Rodney was well known for going to Pan-African congresses and saying, you know, like, this is not just all a happy get-together. What about those of you who claim to be Pan-African and are also ruthlessly exploiting your own people? So as we are all part of the working class here, it is important to say, like, yes, I'm part of the working class, but what does it mean to be a member of the working class who's unionized versus a member of the working class who's not unionized? What does it mean to be a member of the working class who's undocumented versus someone who has their paperwork? And how does that influence that how the working class lives, produces, and reproduces itself? Oftentimes in the United States, what it means is the kind of job you can get as a black or undocumented person is very different from the kind of job you can get as someone with papers, as someone who's white. So a critical examination, not just of the world, but also of ourselves, is the legacy of Walter Rodney. Leo is gonna talk more and has written a book and has much more details, but that'll be it from me. Thanks.
Thank you, Robert. That was brilliant. Thanks so much. Now I'm going to turn it over to our next speaker, who is, and I have just lost. Okay, I'm going to have to wing this because I just accidentally deleted your bio. Okay, sorry. So the next speaker is Leo Zelig, who is here. He's a London-based writer, activist, and socialist. He's written several books, mainly on the modern history of the modern African working class, particularly social movements. He is also the author of three novels, all of which are very good, and is most relevant to this discussion, the recent author of this book from Haymarket, A Revolutionary for Our Time, an excellent biography of Walter Rodney, and is also one of the main editors at the Review of African Political Economy. So let's give a warm welcome to Leo. Thanks.
Thank you very much. It always puts a lot of pressure on people when you get a greet out like that. So just warning you. Don't get your expectations too high. Comrades, it's an enormous privilege to be able to speak on Walter Rodney and to be invited to the socialism event to do that. And I can think of no more appropriate gathering to discuss Rodney's legacy. One of Rodney's extraordinary skills, if you've ever seen a short clip of him speaking, was from a very early age, learning to debate in Guyana. He was able to speak without notes. And, you know, rather like Robert has just illustrated, present an incredibly good presentation in a lot of detail and barely refer to anything that he had written in front of him. Unfortunately, those skills do not extend to me, so you'll have to forgive me for referring quite extensively to my notes. What I want to do is pick up on some of the things that Robert has said, but to look specifically, as a case study, if you like, to Rodney's trip to Hamburg in 1978, which I think was pivotal for a whole number of reasons, which I'll go into. But I want to start with something else. A comrade of Walter's, Kwayana, a comrade in the WPA, in a in an extraordinary essay on Walter Rodney, Prophet of Self-Emancipation, related a talk that Rodney gave soon after he returned to Guyana in 1974. And he writes, "To illustrate the role of propaganda, Rodney told a tale of lions who went to view an art exhibition and were amazed at the claims on the canvas made by hunters and their glorifiers. A lion shook his head with resignation and was heard muttering, 'If only lions could paint.' For me, there is no story that illustrates Walter Rodney's life mission than helping lions to paint." And I hope this will come out in some of the points and the discussion that we'll have. First of all, to lay my cards on the table, I think that Walter Rodney is perhaps one of the greatest activists, thinkers, and revolutionaries of his generation. And as we've heard, his life was cruelly cut short on the 13th of June, 1980. What is notable throughout his life was that he maintained, as we've heard from Robert, this extraordinary rigor of thought and analysis. Never a shortcut, everything in front of him, every source read, a capacity to learn from his comrades and peers, which I have to say is rare among the socialist politics and movements that I've been in, and also, interestingly, in Tanzania in particular, to learn from his students. This is brilliantly summarized by Jesse Benjamin, the Walter Rodney scholar in Atlanta, who writes how real and urgent his search for truth and answers was, but also how undoctrinaire and creative he was in his thinking, studying thoroughly the deep historical roots of each place and then the process of decolonizing our thinking sufficiently to the task of liberation. And he goes on to mention Rodney's interests in physics, his extraordinary, and if we've got time, it would be worth discussing it, interest in the natural world and the environment. I would also say that he was, as we've heard, a Marxist of astonishing depth and originality and rigor. And there are many stories that illustrate this. One is that he received a delegation of students when he was at the University of Dar es Salaam in the late 60s complaining about the rigors of his own teaching and marking and how he insisted on research, but also the sometimes fatiguing processes of referencing work. And for Rodney, there was no shortcut, that we must maintain those rigors of inquiry and of work in order to take on those who are trying to tell a very different story about human development. The family travel, as we've heard, to Tanzania, graduates in record time with a PhD from SOAS in 66, takes up a lectureship at the University of Dar es Salaam a few months after graduation. And just a very brief word about Tanzania at the time. President Julius Nyerere was moving towards a project of state socialism or socialism from above, and it attracted huge and excited attention. In some senses, it was the if not the mecca of revolution, but the mecca of socialism on the continent of that period. Liberation organizations from other struggles around the continent based themselves in Dar es Salaam, largely as a result of this opening up to struggle and liberation that Nyerere allowed. It also attracted a large number of expat fellow travelers of the Ujamaa or familyhood socialism transformation that was underway in the country. Hugely problematic and criticized by Tanzanian comrades, by Rodney later as well, but we'll talk about that. The family stay until 74, and throw themselves into the discussions and debates triggered by the Arusha Declaration outlining the nationalization and collectivization of Tanzania, an effort to drag it back from the underdevelopment of colonial penetration and occupation, largely state-led projects. The university where he is becomes this extraordinary incubator to debates and discussions about the nature of socialism, very detailed conversations about Marxism and socialist politics. Rodney, at this point, is a keen but not uncritical supporter of Nyerere and these projects, extremely critical of the other more conservative briefcase revolutions, as he describes them, across the continent at the time. His work was exhaustive, constant, involved writing, teaching, working with some of the university's most militant students in a number of different organizations. And there are stories of Rodney working on manuscripts, papers, and lectures with his children across his lap, with a capacity to turn from socializing, which he was more than capable of, and partying to work and to his focused projects. In the late 60s and 70s, Rodney also brings the debates and discussions of what Jesse Benjamin describes as a Marxism in which black power is central. And these are debates which I would argue were absolutely key to Rodney's Marxism, and to also the expat life at the University of Dar es Salaam, with all sorts of tensions, including some racial tensions that spill over at different points, which Rodney takes on. He publishes one of the most astonishing books during this period in 72, as Robert has mentioned, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And the book, clearly addressing a black audience, explains the poverty of African societies, how they were dragged back from a position of development, and the continent's position in a global capitalist hierarchy that has systematically bled its wealth, resources, and humanity. Now, what's interesting about the book is it becomes a movement. It's sold on activist stalls in New York, San Francisco, but also in newly independent Africa, in Accra, in Lagos. He receives a massive fan mail requesting his support. One writer from Lagos in 73 says, "I've just bought your book, How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, and I want to inform you that you are one of my heroes. I am just 20 and entering the University of Ibadan next September. So all I need now are inspirations from you." Rodney at this point throws himself into coordinating translations of the book, mailing mass orders of the manuscript, and he feeds it in to this radicalizing black power politics in the States, in which Rodney also, which is a separate story, is a vital and important intellectual force. He leaves with his family, Dar es Salaam, in 74, telling his comrade, Issa Shivji, at the time, who pleads with him to stay, "No, comrade, I can make my contribution here, but I will never be able to grasp the idiom of the people. I will not be able to connect easily. I have to go back to the people I know and who know me." So he returns to Guyana and to the capital, Georgetown, having secured a lectureship in history at the National University. However, Burnham intervenes and forces the university to rescind the appointment. And there's lots of things to say here, not least the dangers of teaching African history and radical teaching today, which is a current campaign in the UK with the sacking, some of you may have heard, of the radical scholar Hakim Adi and his African history courses. But Burnham is also keen to eliminate a critic. However, determined to stay, but without formal employment, Rodley quickly immerses himself in militant organization, the Working People's Alliance, as we've heard. And the period until he's murdered can be characterized as one of extraordinary, intense activism, travel and research, political involvement at WPA, also taking teaching gigs around the world in order to pay for his family's upkeep and to contribute to the WPA and party funds. Rodney's cautious and critical support for top-down projects of socialist transformation in Africa were very much a thing of the past in this period. He had always been critical, and his support was never straightforward. However, with his resolute organizing of the working people in Guyana, there were extraordinary and valuable signs of these shifts, not least what happens in Germany in 1978 on one of these teaching gigs, a course where he's there for 3 months. The lectures that he gives during this course give an impression of an activist and thinker on astonishing form, challenging wide-ranging issues, the continent's history, slavery, independence, projects of radical socialist development, frequently interrupted by students, and you have all of this in the transcripts in the archives in Atlanta, where he's forced to justify a statement, deal with a complex issue of political economy and Marxist theory, and he's able to do it with astonishing sophistication and clarity, never losing patience or his narrative thread. It's a wonder to behold. The lectures are also deeply reflective, referring to his experiences in Tanzania and the conclusions he was drawing on the weaknesses of state socialism. And he writes about the role of the state in Tanzania, which Rodney has seen as a possible vehicle for socialist transformation. But now his attitude had become much more critical. After independence, the so-called official organizations of workers, he says, are a farce, a process of co-option by the state. Independent unions were vacuumed up into a state-controlled organization. But what attracts his particular attention, and which is particularly interesting about this lecture series in Hamburg in 78, is his focus on the strikes and factory occupations in 1973 in Tanzania, where he sees a new politics in formation, a workerist turn, as he describes it. And he writes, describing this period, "We as workers are capable of running this enterprise more efficiently than the economic bureaucracy. In direct challenge to the management of companies, workers were making arguments that went beyond their own immediate material interests. They were carrying the class to even higher levels by, in fact, posing the question, who should control production?" In these struggles from below, Rodney says, he saw a direct challenge to the state that had declared itself socialist and the possibility of a new society based on that class challenge. This is really important. And I quote Rodney once more, speaking the following day, as it turns out, on this same strike wave. "Even though theoretically the Tanzanian revolution, so-called revolution, accepted a greater role for workers, when they made an important policy statement in 71, the workers themselves tried to implement the rights that were supposedly safeguarded by this charter. And as often happens, as we know, by statements that are made from on high, they are seized on as initiatives from below. Workers themselves attempt to implement these demands." Rodney records one case. In one very important instance, workers actually took over a factory. He's talking about the 73 strike wave. And they didn't take it over from the government. They took it over from a private owner. You can see the excitement of Rodney in these words. And they said, "We can run this factory," which was a rubber factory, the Mount Carmel rubber factory. They locked out the management and they were running the factory. And this caused the greatest excitement and fear on behalf of the bureaucracy. And so Rodney, in these lectures, draws the obvious conclusions. And as also the economic bureaucracy, the petty bourgeoisie, as he describes it, were also doing in Tanzania during that period. And the conclusions were these. If workers were running one factory, then maybe they will run another and another. And this doesn't look too good for the economic wing of the bureaucracy. The whole rationale of production as a class will disappear if there was workers' control. So they moved to crush these initiatives. All sorts of fascinating things going on there, not least that this was a conception of socialist and revolutionary transformation from below against a government that was calling itself and declaring itself as socialist and revolutionary. So he's no different, no matter the differences in the complexion of the government's rhetoric, the threat of these strikes and the possibilities of real transformation they contain were the same. The strikes had to be stamped out. Sure enough, they were. Rodney goes on to explain, however, what in English we call wildcat strikes are not strikes which the union initiates, but strikes which come from below. The workers themselves decide on direct action. So it's these unorganized strikes, not prearranged by trade union leaders, that become the center of Rodney's focus in the Hamburg lectures, but also, of course, in his organizing in Guyana. Yet it is not simply a strike, rather what the strike portends. Out of the action, away from the immediate material interests themselves, there were seeds to another power, seeds to another society. And this, of course, key to Rodney's activism and work through his life, in the groundings, in his whole approach to politics. But workers themselves as being the force for self-liberation, self-organization, at the center of his thinking and his organizing. In addition, and as a consequence, Rodney argued that some sort of rehash of national liberation, which at that point was being advocated by the government in Tanzania and by the ruling party, TANU, was not enough. So Nyerere, who he had celebrated and supported and to some extent worked with while he was in Tanzania, who didn't leave the presidency until 85, was attempting to revive the politics of liberation, to reassert the national liberation, as Rodney says. This is what Rodney says about this effort. My feeling is that in spite of all the rhetoric, TANU has not been transformed, that it remains a nationalist party under control of the petty bourgeoisie as it always has, incapable of providing the basis for sustained socialist transformation. In other words, socialist change requires pressure from outside the ruling party and in opposition, and in which revolutionary organization was central. Much as Rodney's WPA was working against the Birnin regime in Guyana. So what Rodney is saying in these lectures, and more broadly in this period, extraordinary last period of his life, in regimes which were profoundly different in Guyana and Tanzania, but where the essential class component was not, if the working class struggle from below in occupations and wildcat strikes was necessary in Guyana, it was also indispensable for the construction of socialism in Tanzania and, of course, across the continent. To those who declared that there was something unique about Tanzania, Rodney was equally dismissive. It is important to recognize, he said, that it fits a general pattern, which we have been discussing so far, by which the colonization process ended through an alliance of classes, but within the alliance, workers and peasants have never dominated. What we see in Hamburg is a political orientation to self-activity, occupations and wildcat strikes, and the working class, not as one player in a coalition, in numerous alliances, but as a central organizing force. A new state, he argued, would not come about by an enlightened leader, but through the frenzy of a class in the process of knowing itself and through what it alone was capable of creating. In this scenario, the existing national bourgeoisie, in Rodney's words, and their whole rationale of production would disappear. The period in Guyana in the late 70s, largely unknown by many, is one of astonishing revolutionary energy and politics and political developments in the WPA. The upturn in 79 and the civil rebellion, as it was called, in the national strikes and the protests and the unity between Indian and African workers offered a glimpse of another world. Tragically, the full development of this politics and its realization under the coordination and leadership of Rodney and his comrades, there was an extraordinary generation of revolutionaries at that time in the WPA, was largely broken by his murder on the 13th of June, 1980. And Robert has spoken about C.L.R. James, and I would say the lecture that he delivers after Rodney dies is partly a lament to a lost son who he had taught, but it is also something else. It contains, I think, within it, the sense of historical loss at Rodney's murder. So it's C.L.R. James understanding what that loss means for the Caribbean, for people of the Global South, and around the world. And Burnham decided that Rodney, as we know, had to be eliminated. The unity that he'd helped to forge between Indian and Afro-Guyanese working people had to be broken. Rodney's emphasis on the self-activity and self-emancipation of the working class, helping the lions to paint, recorded in his Hamburg lectures, was an important moment in an extraordinary life, brutally taken from his family, the people of Guyana and the world. But there remains a huge amount for us still to learn from his work, activism, and life.